they don't pass, what the punishment for failure should be. My eyes grow as heavy as my heart. Though I want to keep working, I know my mind will function better if I rest. Besides, who knows how much sleep I will get in the days to come. I slide a change of clothes along with my papers into my bag and crawl into bed with the bag tucked in beside me. Despite the bulk of it, having my things next to me is strangely comforting. I slept like this every night during the testing and survived. With a lot of luck and the right decisions, I will survive again. My sleep is filled with flashes of memories. The poisonous plants from the second test. Malachi as he touched the wrong part of the pulse radio, sending a nail into his eye. Annalise as she tossed her red hair and swaggered out the door. The city streets with only one path for escape. Will's green eyes staring at me from behind the barrel of his gun as he fired. When I wake, sunlight is streaming through the window. I put my bag on the floor and slide out of bed. Today the president will announce that Michael is missing. The debate will be postponed. The countdown to the rebels' attack will end as mine begins. And the images from last night's dreams give me an idea of how to start. I shower, pull my hair into a knot at the base of my neck, and check the time. There's an hour until my first class starts. Time enough. I place two of the half-inch round trackers I took from President Colander's fifth-floor storeroom into my jacket pocket. The monitor I slide into my bag. Then, after a quick inventory of the mechanical parts I have stored in my bottom desk drawer, I grab my bag and head downstairs to get the other pieces I need. No one is working in the labs this morning. I search through all four of them before I find the items I require. Since I have to get to class soon, I put all the parts in my bag, grab food from the dining hall so I can work through lunch. Then I look for Ian. When I spot him at our usual table sitting across from Rafe, I walk over and slide into the seat beside him. Putting one hand in my pocket, I quietly ask, "Do you have time to talk? I'm leaving for class in a few minutes, but there's something..." I drop my fork, get out of my seat, and kneel down to retrieve it. While doing so, I slip one of the small tracking devices into the side pocket of the bag at his feet. I've never seen Ian put anything in that pocket, but I'm hoping the disc will be small enough to escape his notice if he does. Grabbing my fork, I back out from under the table and take my seat again, keeping my eyes lowered so Ian will think I'm flustered by my mistake. In a quiet voice, I ask, "Is there any word on when we'll be able to leave campus?" "Not yet, which is good in a way. Everyone can catch up on classwork. The campus lockdown is unusual, and I can't imagine it will last very long. If it goes more than a few days, I'm sure some students will feel compelled to break the rule and leave anyway." "What will happen if they get caught?" Ian puts down his fork. "Every head of residence is different. I've heard Professor Markham is pretty lenient about these things. Professor Holt, however, isn't as easygoing. Unless, of course, you're one of her favorites or someone she's asked to do a job for her." The way Ian glances across the room at Griffin leaves no doubt as to whom he's referring. Although Professor Holt has asked favors of Ian in the past, like spying on me, he could be one of those she allows to break the rules without consequence. The tracker will help me learn whether he actually does cross the university boundaries. If so, I will know he's working with Professor Holt. It's not a perfect test, but it's a start. Kind of like step one in the testing process. Once I see what his movements are today, I can decide if there needs to be a round two. Rafe leaves the dining hall when I do and matches his stride to mine as I cross the bridge and head toward the center of campus. He glances over his shoulder, then says, "The president is making her proposal to the debate chamber today. That has to be the reason none of the students are allowed to leave campus. Dr. Barnes and his administrators must not want us to get caught in the crossfire if the attack happens sooner than they planned. That could be part of the rationale. Of course, Rafe doesn't know about the rebel students on campus or their orders to remove any perceived threats to the rebellion. So, have you decided how you're going to get around the tracking devices so we can do something to stop what's about to happen? Or are you still trying to figure out if you can trust me? I do. At least I think we're fighting for the same purpose, but I believed that of Will, and Tomas almost died. There are just some things I have to work out. Once I do, I'll share everything I know.
Well, you'd better do it quick, Sia.
Rafe frowns.
Because, unless I'm mistaken, the time for thinking is running out. If we're going to try to end the testing and change this university, we have to do it before things are locked down so tight that we no longer have a choice.
Rafe stalks off in the direction of the science buildings. As much as I want to follow, I don't. I've only 20 minutes until class begins. I need to find Stacia. We don't have any classes together until tomorrow afternoon, and Rafe is right. I don't have time to wait. I see her walking behind a group of older students toward the humanities building and wave. When she doesn't notice me, I yell her name as I hurry in that direction. She cocks her head as she spots me.
What are you doing over here? Don't you have world history first thing on Monday morning?
I nod and look at the watch on my bag. 15 minutes. Not a lot of time, but enough to say what I need to.
There's something I need to tell you and a favor I have to ask.
We sit on the stone bench near the walkway. I take out a book in order to look as if we're two students comparing homework.
What's so important it couldn't wait?
Stacia asks, brushing a blonde lock of hair behind her ear.
Did Tomas and you break up for real?
She rolls her eyes and waits for me to laugh, as I did when she'd say something like that a month ago. When I don't, her expression turns serious.
President Colander has asked me to assemble a team of people to help her bring down the testing and eliminate the people in charge of it.
Stacia blinks.
This is a joke, right?
She looks at the group of girls walking by us and then lowers her voice.
You're not joking?
I wish I were. I give her a quick synopsis of the tug of war happening over the debate chamber vote and the rebellion the president was counting on that has proved false. Only 5 minutes remain until the start of class when I say, I've learned enough to know that the testing needs to end. Unlike President Dalton in the fourth stage of war, President Colander has chosen to strike against Dr. Barnes and the people who could plunge this country again into war. But I can't do what she asks without your help. 2 minutes. I'm going to have to run to make it to world history in time. Hoping I've given her enough information to at least make her consider helping, I ask,
can you meet me here in 2 hours?
The calculus building is directly across from this bench. I can make it here easily after my second class.
Stacia stands. Sure. If for no other reason, then I'm dying to hear what else you have to tell me.
Don't say anything to anyone until we speak. There are people...
1 minute.
Just don't say anything about this, okay? Or we'll both be really sorry. When Stacia nods, I race across the grass, hoping I haven't just made a mistake. Class is starting when I hurry into the room and take a seat in the back. Professor Lee's raised eyebrow is the only indication that he has noticed my tardiness. While he begins the lecture, I fish a notebook and pencil out of my bag, then leave the bag open beside me so I can see the light of the monitor telling me if Ian's position changes. The need to watch the monitor, the worry that Stacia will not heed the warning I gave her, and the knowledge that Professor Lee is one of the people I'm supposed to eliminate, dominate my thoughts. Professor Lee,
has always seemed so interested in his students living up to their potential, it seems impossible to believe he'd be an advocate for a larger pool of testing candidates. Could he really want to eliminate the potential of so many additional candidates just to provide more competition during the selection process?
What can you tell us, Ms. Vale, about Prime Minister Che?
The sound of my name makes me realize that I haven't been paying attention. I'm just glad Professor Lee said my name before the topic, otherwise I wouldn't be able to answer now. Thankfully, this is a topic that was covered not only in our school back in Five Lakes, but in early studies. Prime Minister Che was the broker for the Asian Alliance. It was his refusal to accept defeat during the Sinai summit that pushed the talks forward. He's also credited with helping maintain peace by encouraging compromise between the leaders of the Asian Alliance. But despite the public's desire to see him lead, Prime Minister Che refused to push himself forward to be the leader of the alliance. Had he accepted leadership, his desire for peace could have prevented the escalation that led to the seven stages of war. Professor Lee studies me.
Is that what you believe?
I feel everyone waiting for me to speak, but I have no idea what to say. Professor Lee smiles and glances around the room.
Is that what you all believe?
Now everyone has been put on the spot, and like me, no one else knows how to respond. A few heads nod, but Professor Lee doesn't speak. It's clear he's waiting for someone to speak, so I do. That's what you taught in early studies. Professor Lee's smile grows wider.
It is. We know certain facts from those years before the seven stages of war. We know Prime Minister Che fought for unity and that while many believed he was out to create a power base for himself, he never tried to gain leadership of the alliance. We also know that he traveled around Japan, China, and North and South Korea, stressing the need to put aside differences and follow the new laws. After that, we know very little, which is why you have only been taught and tested on those facts. Today, I'd like to talk about what we don't know.
The confusion on my fellow students' faces must be mirrored on my own. I'd heard about the sequence of events that led up to the seven stages of war before I started school. I've been tested on them in Five Lakes, during the testing, and throughout early studies. The idea that there is more information that I've never been told has me leaning forward in my seat, waiting for whatever Professor Lee will say next. His smile disappears.
Prime Minister Che's involvement in the Great Treaty, his call for peace, and his death are well documented. However, very little about the years when he stepped out of the limelight have been verified, which is why you've never discussed the possibilities behind those dormant years. I'd like to remedy that today.
Walking up and down past the aisles of desks, Professor Lee talks at length about the mystery that surrounds Prime Minister Che's decision to step away from the government for 10 years, only to reappear when the alliance was threatened because Mongolia seized land from China. Prime Minister Che re-emerged and once again brokered peace, a movement developed in every Asian alliance country. People demanded that the current alliance leader step down and that Che take his place. According to Professor Lee, books that survived that period suggest Che spent the early part of those mystery years traveling throughout the alliance countries, cultivating followers while professing to support the current leader. It's never been confirmed, but there were rumors that Che was spotted in Mongolia not long before its president directed his troops to cross the border into China. Since so much of our world's history was only documented with technology that was lost during the wars, no one knows for certain whether these events are rumor or fact. Professor Lee says, pausing near my desk.
If they are true, then I think it is very possible that Che's well-known selflessness was a cover for his true intent, to become the leader of the Asian alliance by prompting the Mongolian president to create a threat that would thrust Che back into the political arena. If this speculation is correct, Che laid the groundwork so that it would appear he only took the reins as head of the allied governments by humbly accepting the will of the people. Professor Lee smiles. His plan could have succeeded had he not been assassinated. After that, you know the rest of the story. Civil war broke out in the Asian alliance as each country accused another of the assassination. The unrest prompted the Mideastern coalition to attack Japan. One by one, every country was pulled into the war as tensions around the world exploded. Eventually, the rumors of Chancellor Friedrich's involvement were confirmed, but by then, the unrest was too great to turn back. Bombs were dropped, cities leveled. The population of the world was reduced to a fraction of what it once had been. I thought I had understood the reason why our world was destroyed, but if Professor Lee is correct, we have only been taught part of our history. That shouldn't be a surprise, considering how much was lost in the seven stages of war. Those who lived through the war were intent on survival, not on preserving our past. It is interesting to speculate on what might have happened had Prime Minister Che not been assassinated, and even more fascinating to consider what history might look like had he chosen to retain his role in the government and not pushed for more. President Lee surveys the room and glances at the clock. Our time is up, though after what I've learned, I don't want to leave, not if there's still more to hear. My classmates must feel the same. Not a single student has begun to pack up. "And now for your assignment," Professor Lee says. "I would like you to consider what we know to be fact about the state of the world governments at that time, and write a paper telling me what you believe would have happened had Prime Minister Che not been assassinated. I wish to be dazzled by your keen political and historical insight. Those who impress me most will be selected to participate in a special seminar, one that will discuss what is happening outside of the United Commonwealth right now and speculate on what might happen next." He closes the book in front of him, grins at the stunned expressions of everyone in the room, and heads out the door. Despite everything that has happened over the past couple of days, I can't help but feel a spurt of excitement at the idea of delving deeper into our past and discovering what is happening outside our country. Are there others fighting to restore the Earth? Could the course of action I've decided upon affect more than just the Commonwealth? I want to believe that Chancellor Friedrich had Prime Minister Che assassinated not to retain power, as some believe, but because the action would keep the alliance stable. Instead, it plunged nations into a war that led to the downfall of the world. Dr. Barnes is not Prime Minister Che. He has not been an advocate for peace. Yet his work selecting leaders has helped revitalize this country. While I think the testing is a terrible betrayal of everything I've been taught to believe in, others might not agree. I'm betting that some testing candidates, if their memories were restored, might even see Dr. Barnes as a savior. Will Stacia be one of them? I'm still thinking about this and the events that have made me resolve to employ some of the same principles used in the testing as Enzo and I walk together to our next class, Advanced Calculus. I haven't yet decided what test I can give him, and I wonder if the fact that he knows I killed Damone and hasn't reported me to Professor Holt is test enough. But it isn't, because I don't know where his family's loyalty lies. As we walk up the steps of Science Building 4, Enzo stops me and asks, "Is everything okay?" I blink. "I just know you're going through a lot with everything that's happened."
Is he referring to my part in Damone's death or to something else? He jams his hands into his pockets and keeps his voice low.
I just wanted you to know that if you need someone to talk to, I'm a good listener. My father always says the reason I seem smarter than the rest of my brothers is because I watch and listen to everyone else instead of jumping in and getting my hands dirty.
Jumping in before you know what you're getting into is a good way to get hurt, I say, wondering why he's pushing to bring himself into my confidence. What does he think I'm doing? And what would he do with the information if I gave it to him? The intensity with which he waits for me to say something more makes me certain that there is another agenda aside from friendship at play. Trying to sound casual, I add, I appreciate the offer, but I'm not ready to talk. Enzo shrugs.
Well, I just thought since I saw... Well, you know, that I sort of understood and that I can be trusted.
The more he tells me I can rely on him, the less I want to. Thanks, I say. It's nice to know you stand by your friends. When Enzo shifts his weight and looks uncomfortable with my gratitude, I say, come on, we don't want to be late for class. It's a good thing we aren't. Our professor assigns 8 pages of homework, most of which deals with equations he covered in the first few minutes. I'm so busy writing notes I barely have time to glance down at the tracking monitor in my bag to verify that Ian's device is still on campus, where Ian said he was going to be. When the professor is done answering questions about the assignment, he announces that Professor Jade is not on campus today. My next class, United Commonwealth History and Law, is canceled along with the others Professor Jade teaches, which gives me a 2-hour window until my next lecture. Time enough to talk again to Stacia and, I hope, construct an appropriate test for Rafe. Stacia is waiting where I last saw her. Before I can take a seat, she stands and says, you don't have to convince me that what you said the president asked you to do is the truth. At first I thought it must be an elaborate joke, but I know you wouldn't joke about something like that. So, tell me what I can do to help. Just like that? I ask. Walking here, I'd come up with all the things I could say that would convince her to be a part of this team. Dr. Barnes runs this university. If we were still in the testing, I'd probably side with him, since he'd control whether or not I got here. But the president's in charge of the country. If we succeed, I'll be a hero. Heroes get more options for their future. They also have more power. I want both. So, where do we go from here? Good question. I have something I need to do in the early studies building. We can talk about it there. From what I've heard, the building's classrooms and labs are only used in the beginning of the school year. Once students are divided into their designated areas of study, the facilities are rarely utilized until the following year. If that holds true today, Stacia and I should be able to work there on a test for Rafe while talking through the details she needs to know. I'm assuming Tomas is part of our little band? Stacia asks as we head up the steps of the building. As with all of the university educational buildings, the front door is unlocked during daylight hours. The labs on the first floor are open and empty. The rest of the building is silent. I tell her yes as I lead us into the chemistry lab, a large room with 10 black tables, behind each of which stand 2 silver stools. Light streams in from 3 large windows that face the back lawn of the building. In the front of the room is a large floor-to-ceiling gray cabinet filled with chemicals, microscopes, burners, and other tools. I set my bag on the table least visible from the windows, open it, and take out the tracking monitor so I can watch it while I work. Ian is still on campus, only a couple of buildings away. What's that? I explain about the tracking device I placed in Ian's bag and the tests I need to create for Rafe and Enzo. How many people are on the list the president gave you? 12. I run down the names on the list and the reasons the president gave for each one. Stacia seems surprised to hear that the head of her residence is on the list, but doesn't interrupt. While I speak, I pull out the other items I brought with me. 6 4-inch square pieces of steel, wires, a switch, a thumb-sized solar battery. More metal for a circuit board.
What are you doing?
Building a pulse radio, or at least something that will look like one, I say as I work to attach wires. I want Rafe to believe there's information recorded on this that will help the president bring an end to the testing.
Why?
I'm still working out the details, but if he takes it out of my room or finds a way to steal it, I'll know he can't be trusted to follow my lead. I need people who are willing to stop the testing, but whom I can also depend on at any cost.
And then what?
Stacia crosses her arms.
Rafe isn't stupid. If he takes the recorder and figures out that the recording isn't real, he'll know you're on to him. The minute he tells his father or one of the administrators on your list, we're all in trouble.
I put down my tools and sigh. Do you have a better idea?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Stacia takes the box I have built in her hands and turns it over.
If Rafe fails this test, there has to be a consequence that ensures he's unable to tell anyone about it. And the only way to guarantee that is if after failing the test, Rafe is dead.
Chapter 8.
I can't.
Stacia's cool, calculating eyes meet mine. You're planning on killing Dr. Barnes and 11 of his supporters. You really think one more is going to matter to the president as long as you help her achieve her goal?
No, I whisper. I'm certain it won't, but it matters to me. Rafe saved my life.
My legs begin to tremble. I place my hands on the cool work table as a wave of dizziness crashes over me.
Just because you like Rafe doesn't mean he's not a threat. As far as I can tell, you have two choices. Keep him out of this, or give him a test that will allow us to know if you're right to trust him, and that will remove him from the equation if you're wrong.
Keep Rafe out of this plan? I doubt he would let that happen. He already knows about the false rebellion and the true nature of the testing. More, he's aware of my understanding of both. He will be watching what I do. If he's not a member of my team, he will certainly interfere with or possibly work against us. Even without knowing what I'm about to do, Rafe could cause this plan to fail. My brother and the rebels could die. The testing would continue, and the rest of the country... It's impossible to know what the repercussions would be, but I know I can't risk them happening, not if I can potentially stop them. Trying not to think about what I'm doing, I slide the second tracking device into the box. Then I go to the cabinets where chemicals are stored. Locked. Not a surprise, but also not a deterrent, since the same kind of closure was on the wooden chests where my brothers used to store their personal items. When I was little, they teased me by hiding my favorite rag doll in those locked containers. Since my father believed in fair play, he taught me to pop the locks on the chests with a wire or thin piece of metal. Once my brothers learned I could open the locks, they stopped taking my doll. I haven't had reason to use that skill much since then, but I haven't lost the ability. Within moments, the cabinet doors stand open. As Stacia compliments my breaking and entering skills, I find what I need to create something else my father taught me, something that could serve the purpose that Stacia suggests. Potassium nitrate, charcoal powder, and sulfur powder. Stacia nods as I put the chemicals on the table and start to measure, hoping that I recall the proper ratios. I mete out the same amounts of each chemical twice. So when I'm done, there are two bowls that contain 75% potassium nitrate and smaller amounts of sulfur and charcoal. I keep an eye on the clock as the two of us grind the chemicals together. The process is slow, but dividing the labor makes it go quicker. Stacia passes the time by chatting.
I can understand why the president might want to stop it, but the testing can't be all bad. I mean, there has to be some kind of benchmark for who gets to be in charge and who doesn't. Killing candidates seems like an extreme method of making that choice, I say. Although I can't help but think of what I'm doing now and wonder if my choices are just as extreme. I can't imagine they kill everyone who doesn't pass, right? Stacia stops and looks at me. I mean, this country is still rebuilding. Killing off over 80 testing candidates every year isn't logical. Then what do you think happened to them? I've often wondered if the candidates who weren't killed as direct penalties for failure have survived. I don't know. Stacia starts her work again. We can't remember our testing, but who's to say it was as bad as you've been told? And even if it is, think about the penalty for leaders who fail. They're not the only ones who suffer the consequences when that happens. How else can you tell if someone can handle that? Stacia's calm reasoning is disturbing because I can see the logic in her words. There has to be another way, I reply. Well, there's going to have to be, since we're going to end it. But you have to wonder whether the president would be asking you to do this if the testing hadn't already told her what you're capable of. What happens once the testing has ended and they need leaders who are willing to do whatever it takes to help this country survive? Just because someone says they're capable doesn't make it true, and just because you think something is wrong doesn't mean it isn't necessary. If you think the testing is necessary, why are you working with me to end it? Stacia's smile is hard and so very familiar. It makes me shiver now, especially when she says, "Because I want my chance to make sure the mistakes that ruined this country never happen again. If I have to kill to make that a reality, then that's what I'll do." Stacia laughs. "Besides, you'd never do anything you weren't certain was absolutely right. If you believe that by ending the testing will prevent a potential civil war, that's good enough for me." My breath catches. My chest tightens as Stacia's casually spoken words settle on my shoulders like a yoke. She is here because I asked. She will kill not out of passion for the purpose we have, but because of me. My request, my beliefs, my choices. I can only hope they are the right ones. We work in silence for the next half hour. By the time the powder is ground, our arms are tired. Stacia helps me strain the black powder, then test it by putting a small pinch of the substance on a block of wood. I put the wood on a table, touch the match to it, and step back as the substance ignites. A flame several inches high burns bright, then fades. It doesn't take long for us to put shredded paper and the black powder into the fake pulse radio I constructed. Then I slide two wires into the holes and wrap black adhesive tape around the lid to ensure that the wires stay in place and no powder escapes the holes. I check the switch on the radio to make sure I have built it properly. To engage the power source, someone must flip the switch and then turn a knob 180 degrees. It's a design sometimes used to make sure power is not wasted if a switch is mistakenly turned to the on position. Stacia takes a step back as I connect the other ends of the wires to my power source. I count to 10, and then let out an exhale of relief when the device stays quiet in my hands. "Well, that was amazing to watch. I'm glad to know I'm on your side." Her grin is wide and delighted. "So, when do you plan on giving this to Rafe? I want to make sure I'm far away in case he decides to give it a whirl." "I don't know." Now that I'm holding it in my hands, I can visualize him turning the dial, igniting the powder, getting caught in the explosion. "Take advantage of the first opportunity that presents itself. If we want to succeed, we don't have time to waste." Knowing she's right, I carefully pour the last of the black powder into a small specimen container, seal the lid, and put it in my bag, along with a book of matches from the cabinet.
Together, we clean up the evidence that someone has been in this room, secure the cabinet doors, and gather our things. I remove one of the single-frequency radios from my bag and hand it to Stacia. I'll let you know when I'm done testing the others, and we can move on to the next step. For now, I have to get to class.
Why?
Stacia slides the radio next to her books and tosses her hair. Something tells me skipping a few classes isn't really going to affect our grades from here on out. Maybe not, but until we start our attack, we need to stick to our normal routines.
Well, no one will be surprised if I'm late, she smiles. Professor Frick isn't exactly punctual himself. I'll see you in class tomorrow if I don't hear from you sooner.
As she leaves, she looks down at the table where the test for Rafe sits.
And good luck.
Carefully, I pick up the device, slide it into my bag, and notice that the red message light is lit on my oscillating pulse radio. Tomas.
I'm hoping this thing works. I've been asking some of the upper years about Drew Owens, and I think I have news. Meet me after class at the greenhouse. With internships canceled, it should be a good place to meet. Oh, and Sia, I love you.
Those words give me the strength to pick up my bag and walk to the door. This test for Rafe is too much like something Dr. Barnes or his officials would have dreamed up. But Tomas suffered the consequences of my confidence in the wrong person before. This time, it won't just be Tomas, but the rebels, and maybe the rest of the country that suffers. Stacia is right. If Rafe understands he's been tested and has failed, his reaction could have serious consequences not only for me and those who are working with me, but for the rebels and future testing candidates. I can't afford to be wrong about Rafe. I have to be sure, and I can't think of another way. The professor is ready to begin lecturing when I slip into a seat near the front of my world languages class. Will raises an eyebrow when he catches my attention. I just smile and shrug as if my almost being late to class isn't unusual. I take notes and try to concentrate as the professor discusses the languages of the Asian Alliance countries, but all the while I'm glancing down at my bag to check the monitor. Two lights blink close together. One, not far from the building in which I sit, belongs to Ian. The other belongs to the potentially deadly device sitting at my feet. Class ends. I turn in my homework, write down the instructions for this week's assignment, and move on to my next class, chemistry. Rafe sits next to me. My heart pounds as the seconds count down. Stacia said I should seize the first opportunity that presents itself. This is it. Somehow I'm able to stand without trembling when class ends. My voice is dispassionate when I ask Rafe if he has a minute to talk.
Are you okay?
He asks after the other students head out of the room.
You look upset.
Are you going back to the residence now?
I was planning on it. Do you want to walk back with me?
I can't. I wait for the last student to leave before saying, I have to meet somebody, but I don't want to take something with me while I do. It's too important. I open my bag and remove the metal box I created.
What is it?
He turns the device over in his hands. It's a recording Tomas found, one that might be helpful in ending everything, if I can get it to the president. I take a deep breath. I'm hoping the restriction against leaving campus will be lifted by tomorrow and I can get it to her then, but I don't want to have it on me now in case something goes wrong at this meeting. I'd give it back to Tomas, but...
I have it covered, Rafe assures me. But it sounds like wherever you're going might be dangerous. Are you sure you should be going alone? Maybe you should let me.
I'll be fine. This is something I have to do by myself. But I need you to promise me that you won't play the message. The recording device sounds faulty. I'm worried the pulse signal might not hold up for more than one additional play. A tempting opportunity for someone who is looking to aid Simon and Dr. Barnes. Tracking down the recordings of the testing should have proved that Rafe and I have the same goals, but there's a chance that he learned through his father about Simon and the false rebellion and knew those recordings would eventually be destroyed. If he plays this recording, I will know where his loyalties lie. And if he gives it to someone else to play, they will pay the price. Either way, I will have the answer I seek. A flicker of annoyance crosses Rafe's face. Almost as quickly as it appears, it's gone.
Are you at least going to tell me what's on it, or is that information only for you and your boyfriend?
I'll tell you everything later tonight. Everything. I stress, meeting his angry eyes. I promise. I see the anger fade.
Okay, he says. Then I promise too. Take care of yourself and don't forget what you just said. I'm holding you to it.
I watch him tuck the device I created in his bag, and I wonder if this is the last time we will see each other. The explosive I built is much like the ones my father and brothers used in their work when they needed to break apart rock. The amount of powder I used should severely injure or kill. If Rafe decides to listen and potentially eliminate the message he believes is there, he'll flip the switch, turn the dial, and draw a spark from the wires that should ignite the powder I created. Rafe and I walk out of the building together. As he heads toward the residence with the device, I picture the paper and powder igniting, and then the blast. I want to run after him and take the device back, but I remember Stacia's words. That which is wrong is sometimes necessary. As I turn and walk in the other direction, I wonder if the testing officials tell themselves that too. The sun is bright. The warmer weather combined with the brisk walk makes me sweat. Surrounding me are signs that spring has come to Tosu City. Greener grass, buds transforming into leaves and flowers preparing to bloom. All signs of hope. I cling to that hope as I check the tracking monitor. Both devices are close by. One looks as if it's near the government studies residence, Rafe. The other is somewhere southeast of my position. I would guess that Ian is at the library. Regardless, I know he's still on campus. Taking that as a good omen, I pick up my pace as I head for the stadium and the greenhouse that sits at its center. Long ago, the structure was used for sports events, but after the seven stages of war, scientists needed a controlled environment in which to plant and cultivate their new specimens. Since this building had no logical purpose in the new culture of revitalization, the country's top botanists enclosed the open space in the center of the structure with glass to create an enormous greenhouse and modified the surrounding rooms within the outer ring to function as genetics labs. Depending on the day, this area can be filled with activity as students, biologists, and various officials go about their work. Without internships compelling students to work, the building appears to be deserted. I check the pulse radio recorder to see if Tomas has left a message as to where exactly he wants me to find him, but the light is not illuminated. While the stadium seems to be a good place to meet, it's huge. Just inside the front entrance seems like the most logical place, so I head in that direction. As I walk, I turn on the transit communicator in case Zine has news. When he doesn't answer my call, I look around to see if anyone is nearby and looking my way. No one. I've toured this building, but I've had little need to use it, although Tomas has. After being assigned to biological engineering, he was forced to go through a potentially deadly induction test here. Of all the designated fields of study, biological engineering most often works in this building, which is why it makes sense that Tomas wants to meet here. The stadium entrance is open. I walk through the doors into the dimly lit corridor and look up and down the two hallways that lead away from here. No Tomas. I've taken a couple steps down one hall to look for signs of a common waiting area when I hear footsteps behind me.
See ya,
a male voice whispers. I turn and squint down the shadowed corridor. Since this building is so large, the halls and most of the rooms are not illuminated unless they're in use. Most of the power collected by the enormous solar panels affixed to the roof is directed into maintaining the controlled climate in the greenhouse. A figure steps into view.
Tomas?
I ask. But I know it's not. The shoulders are too broad, the hair just a fraction too long. My instincts scream for me to turn and run. And I do. Chapter 9. I hear a voice curse. Someone must have known about our meeting and followed me in. To do what? I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I don't want to find out. Blood pounds in my ears as I run, away from whoever is now running behind me. Away from the entrance, away from what I'm almost certain means an end to a plan I've barely embarked upon. The footsteps behind me sound like they're getting closer. I dart around the large steel beam supports and follow the hallway as it curves to the left. I'm fast. The person behind me is faster. And chances are whoever it is knows this building far better than I do. I am at a disadvantage, but if my pursuer thinks I'll give in easily, he or she is mistaken. My bag bounces against my side as I run. The jostling throws me off balance, and I shift the strap over my head to better secure the bag at my side. I glance at the closed doors that I pass. Any one of them could give me a place to hide, but if the door I choose is locked, my pursuer will catch up. I see a set of stairs to the right and race to them. My muscles burn as I climb. When I reach the first landing and head for the second flight of stairs, I brave a look. Dark hair, white jacket, angry expression. Dark eyes that are focused on me. There's something vaguely familiar about him. If I had time to stop and think, I might be able to place him, but at the moment, I've learned what I need to know. The boy behind me doesn't have a weapon, and he's halfway up the staircase to the landing. The first gives me the advantage I've been missing. The second tells me that if I want to capitalize on his lack of defense, I have to move even more quickly. My breath comes hard and fast as I climb step after step while unfastening the closure to my bag. My fingers find the wooden butt of my gun as I hear the boy reach the landing below and begin to climb the next flight of stairs. Good. Let him come. The higher he climbs, the better. When I reach the top, I don't allow myself time to think. I just pull the gun out of my bag, turn, and fire. The boy jumps to the left and then stumbles and goes tumbling down the stairs. He groans as he hits the platform with a thud. The sound gives me a hum of satisfaction as I race down the corridor to the left. Behind me, I hear the boy swear and start his climb again. Even though I missed, the pain and frustration in his voice tell me he isn't as fast as he was, which is all I can really hope for. Hitting a moving target while I'm also in motion requires far more skill than I have. The only way I'm going to hit anything is by chance. But my pursuer doesn't know that. And now that he's aware of my weapon, he'll be forced to move more cautiously. I glance behind and see he's reached the top of the stairs. I fire again. This time the bullet hits the ground somewhere in front of him. He drops to the floor. I keep running. Around the curved corridor, down the hall, I turn and fire once more to ensure he stays off balance, then bolt for the stairs that lead back down to the first floor. If I'm lucky, I'll find an unlocked exit and make my escape. If not, I will learn how accurate my shooting skills really are. I fight to breathe. My muscles burn from exertion. Sweat streaks down my back as I fly down the stairs. One flight. Two. I dash down the hall toward the doors I first came through, glance back to see if the boy has gained on me, and hear the rustle of fabric a second before I collide with someone. Hands grab my arms, and I fight to get free as a voice yells, "Sia?" "Tomas."
Sia, what are you doing? What's going on?
Somewhere above, footfalls sound.
Someone's upstairs. We have to get out of here.
A couple of students might be working on a project. I thought the place would be empty, but we can always...
No, someone was waiting for me to arrive, and he's chasing me now. We have to run.
The sound of shoes pounding the metal stairs makes Tomas look up. From my position, I see a leg step off the landing. Tomas's eyes widen as he spots the person's face.
Carrick.
For a moment, Tomas goes still. Then he shakes his head as Carrick barrels down the stairs. Tomas looks around the room and takes a step to the left.
But if Carrick is here, then...
A gunshot punches the air to my right, and a figure steps out of one of the rooms. I don't think. I set myself, aim, and fire. The answering scream tells me I've managed to hit something. I don't wait to see who I shot. I just grab Tomas's arm and yell for him to move. I don't understand what's happening, but I do know that if Tomas hadn't moved, he would be dead. We reach the end of the hall. Gunshots rip through the air. Tomas flinches with each shot, but whoever is shooting must be as skilled as hitting a moving target as I am, because the bullets don't come close to our position. Of course, that could change at any moment. I spot an exit to the right, but Tomas grabs my hand and pulls me down the hall to the left.
Come on.
He leads me through a wide arching doorway that runs into the center of the stadium. My throat burns with each breath. I climb the steps that lead to the entrance to the greenhouse. Tomas punches a code into a panel. The door slides open and he pulls me through. The smell of growing plants and rich soil hits me first, followed by the air thick with moisture.
This way.
I've been in this room only once before, during my first university tour, and then only for a few minutes. Nothing here is familiar, and I'm running out of ammunition. I can only hope that whatever Tomas has planned will get us out of this situation. Tomas pulls me through several rows of oak saplings and through a grove of reed-thin elms near an area that is surrounded by a small red-wire fence.
There's a control booth over this way that runs the irrigation, power, and climate for the greenhouse. Go there.
He begins pulling the knee-high red fence out of the earth.
Carrick and Marin can't be allowed to leave here, not unless we want them coming after us again or reporting us to someone who can do something worse. Go.
Understanding what he's trying to do, I run to the 20-foot square patch of the greenhouse and help yank the fence out of the ground, removing the barrier that warns people about the plants contained inside. Plants my father has spent his lifetime eradicating. Mancinella flowers, pink ivy, poppy doll eyes, red jessamine. Flowers and plants that, if touched or tasted, can shut down nervous systems and cause cardiac arrest, blindness, vomiting, and dozens of other awful side effects. For some, ingestion is necessary to trigger the poison, but the mancinella flower and pink ivy only require the simplest touch for infection to occur. And poppy doll eye berries can cause severe hallucinations, the walls of veins to thin, and hearts to stop beating. Terrible plants. Mutations caused by the chemicals unleashed upon the world. Those grown here are used for study so that scientists can figure out how to eradicate their effects. Today, Tomas and I need their deadly qualities to keep us alive. Careful not to touch the toxic plants, Tomas and I shift the fence to an area that contains edible vegetation.
Now what? I ask. Now we have to get them to come in this direction and hope they don't notice what they're stumbling into. Carrick is in biological engineering, but he deals more with animal studies than plants. I just wish we had a way to burn some of the plants. There are burners in some of the labs, but we don't have time to waste getting them. Maybe...
I have an idea, I say, opening my bag and grabbing the matches I took from the chemistry lab and the specimen container where I stored the excess black powder.
What's that?
Something that can set the plants on fire.
I keep one eye on the entrance in the distance as I place the paper with the black substance near the patch of plants Tomas thinks has the best chance of making this plan work. Poppy doll eyes. When burned, this plant gives off fumes that will overload the nervous system. Something people from Pierre Colony learned when a spark from a researcher's campfire landed on dry grass near a large patch of the plants with the white bulbs that look like tiny eyes. The fire combined with high winds caused everyone living on the outskirts of the colony to suffer muscle spasms, blindness, or in many cases, death. With the amount of powder I've used, a flame should flare high and wide enough to make the white bulbs hanging nearby catch on fire. The only tricks will be to get our two attackers to come in this direction and to create a fuse long enough to allow me to get to the exit 80 feet behind this point before the smoke caused by the burning plants can reach me or Tomas.
Here.
Tomas hands me a thin 10-inch strip of paper. Not as long or as reliable a fuse as I would like, but the shouts I hear and the figure bursting through the greenhouse door tell me I'm out of time. I lay the fuse on the paper and push a coating of powder onto the end. I fumble for the matches and pull one from the book.
"Get their attention,"
I whisper as I poise the match against the strike pad. Tomas looks at the black powder and the match, then back at me. Nodding, he stands. He takes several steps toward the greenhouse door. He pretends to stumble over an evergreen shrub and swears. That's all it takes. Carrick's head swings in our direction.
"They're over there!"
Tomas looks back over his shoulder and makes for the exit behind us. Carrick and Marin trample plants and weave around young trees as they race for our position. Tomas yells,
"Sia, come on!"
"My foot is caught," I yell back.
"Go, I'll catch up."
Carrick and the other person come closer. For the first time, I get a glimpse of Marin. She's someone I've seen around campus. I think I've even noticed her talking to Tomas. Her most distinctive features are her smile and contagious laughter. She isn't laughing now as she closes the distance between us. A gunshot rings out. I hear the bullet hit the ground far behind me, aimed at Tomas. Another shot. Carrick and the girl move closer. Everything inside me screams at me to flee, but I hold my position as I pretend to struggle to free myself from the phantom vine that holds me hostage. I need their attention directed at me, not on the nearby plants. They come closer. Just a few more seconds. 5. Another shot. 4. Carrick spots me and yells. 3. The girl sees me and smiles. 2. I press the match hard against the strike pad and pull. 1. The match flares. A gunshot makes me jump. The bullet slams into the ground to my right as I touch the flame to the paper fuse. The second I see the flame traveling up the paper, I scramble to my feet and run. Another shot. I stumble and pitch forward as pain sears my calf. I swallow the scream that wants to erupt from inside me and tamp down my body's protest as I climb to my feet. Marin calls out to Carrick. Tomas yells for me to hurry. I glance behind me and realize too much time has passed. The fuse should have ignited the powder. The plan didn't work, and Carrick and the girl are coming. I will myself forward.
"Come on, Sia!"
One step, two, faster.
"What's that?"
I hear Carrick yell. The smell of sulfur reaches me. I hear another gunshot and someone starts to cough. I don't look back. I just keep moving one boot in front of the other, clenching my teeth against the pain that would otherwise bring me to my knees. Tomas already has the exit door open. His eyes are bright with fear as he holds out his hand, beckoning to me. Someone is still running behind me. I stumble through the door and Tomas slams it shut. His fingers fly over the control panel. The light above the door shifts from green to red, and now it can only be opened from this side. A smart move, although one glance through the door's glass pane tells me it wasn't necessary. Carrick is on the ground 20 feet from the exit. His body jerks as if connected to a stream of electricity. I can see the agony on his face as the toxins he breathed in take over his body, shut down his systems, end his life. Chapter 10. I force myself to watch Carrick die. No matter the reason, I helped cause this. I don't know anything about Carrick save his name, his field of study, and the fact that he wanted to harm me. Tears swell behind my eyes and sear my throat as I try to hold them back. But there is no denying them. The death of the boy, the pain burning my calf, and the knowledge that more people will die before this week is done are impossible to suppress. Tomas's arms pull me close. He tries to make me look away, but I can't. My eyes stay focused on the scene behind the glass as feelings storm through me. Sorrow, despair, fear. Carrick's still body swims in and out of focus as tears continue to flow. I feel Tomas's hands touch my injured leg. Fingers probe my wound. The screams I've been holding back claw out of my throat. "I'm sorry, Sia," Tomas says. His voice soothes even as his hands continue to touch the wound and cause pain. "We need to clean and bandage this. It looks like the bullet only grazed your calf, but it's bleeding pretty bad. There's a first aid room just down the hall. I think there should be something in there that I can give you for the pain." "It's not that bad," I lie. "We should get out of here while we can. I don't know where the girl went, but she could be nearby." Tomas looks toward the greenhouse and shakes his head. "She's not going to be coming after us. Marin's in there." Despite the angry protest of my leg, I push to my knees. I follow the direction of Tomas's gaze, squint through